Welcome to today's episode of Money Mountaineering with actuary and author Peter Neuwirth, a new show on the Incandescent Radio Network. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, producer of the show, and I am thrilled to have Pete bring his insight and wisdom about money to a wide audience of listeners and viewers. After graduating from Harvard with a degree in mathematics and linguistics in 1979, Pete has held actuary leadership positions at consulting firms around the country. His two books, Money Mountaineering and What's Your Future Worth, are fascinating insights about what money is and how it can best serve us throughout our lives and help us leave a legacy. Today is episode one of the show, and it's going to be fascinating given our special guest, Barry H. Sachs, PhD. He earned that degree in semiconductor physics from MIT. He then taught at UC Berkeley, and then he earned a JD from Harvard Law School and became a certified specialist in taxation law from the California Board of Legal Specialization. After spending 35 years as an ERISA attorney, that's E-R-I-S-A, he specialized in qualifying retirement plans and used his breadth of skills to discover a role for a reverse mortgage, which helps make a retirement portfolio last longer. I can't wait to hear what you two are going to talk about and share with all of us. So take it away, Pete.
Well, thanks very much, Hope. And I'm really thrilled to do this. And I never thought I'd be hosting a radio show, but it's going to be easy because I've got, as my first guest, a guy I've known for 20 years. And thank you, Barry, for being here. I met Barry, like I said, about 20 years ago when I was an actuary in working for Watson Wyatt and was the actuary for the San Francisco Symphony, and walked in, and there to attend the meeting was the ERISA counsel for the symphony, who was Barry Sachs. And since then, I've learned a whole lot more about Barry, and we've worked together and collaborated on a number of research projects. And the first thing I want to start out with is something I learned very early on was that Barry was not always a tax lawyer or an ERISA attorney, that in fact, he started out as a physicist. So Barry, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, there I was actually teaching physics to the engineers at UC Berkeley and enjoying it quite a bit. But I had a whole bunch of friends that went back to grade school and junior high and high school, all of whom became lawyers. And they seemed to be having more fun than I was having, even though I was having a good time. And at the same time, I had a few other events in my life. I got dumped by my then fiance and thought, you know, I just turned 30. That was the other thing that happened. And that perfect storm of events led me to think, you know, at 30, if I don't try to be a lawyer like my buddies, Dickie and Phil and Larry, then I might hate myself when I was 40. So I took a chance. I applied to law school. And as it happened, I got in. And then I thought, well, you know, why not? And sure enough, by the time I was 40, I was a partner in a law firm.
And did you find that tax law was in any way similar or related to physics?
Very similar. That is to say, I was dealing with quantitative analysis as a physicist. I was a theoretician, and I made mathematical models of things and determined actually something about electron flow in semiconductors. And it had a curious similarity to cash flow. And it was quantitative, it was analytic. Physics had certain fundamental equations. And from the fundamental equations, there were variations called perturbations. And perturbations were the variations. As it turned out, in tax law, there's the tax code, and then there's regulations, which are perturbations on the fundamental rules. So there was very much a similarity in concept and in thought process. And also, what it's worth, tax law has much more of a, let me put it the other way, less of a fighting context than does litigation. I could never imagine myself yelling, "Objection, Your Honor." I could certainly imagine myself, as it ultimately happened, having a conversation analytically with an IRS agent. And that worked fine.
But I presume it's more Newtonian and not relativistic or quantum mechanical, since, you know, I guess in quantum mechanics, you can have a particle that's in two places at the same time. Whereas I guess in tax law, you can't deduct something twice, right?
That's for sure. Yeah.
Well, in any event, I guess we worked together for quite some time as
more than one client in common.
And that was great. But long about 2012, you started to veer off the tax lawyer track a little bit, didn't you, when you did your first research?
Well, actually, it started quite a bit earlier than that.
Okay.
It started while I was still practicing law in a law firm, that is in the early 2000s, well before 2012. And as I was getting closer to my own retirement, I got interested in the sort of flip side of what I had been doing a lot of during law practice. That is, during law practice, I had helped clients, along with my very own law firm, put away as much money as possible into the various kind of qualified retirement plans and thereby get as much deduction as possible. And of course, as time went on and I reached the magic age of 65, which was just around 2005, I began to think very seriously about the opposite direction, money outflow, or as they call it in the business, decumulation. And I got very interested in decumulation. I read an article by some economists, one of whom Pete knows, in fact, and I wrote what I called a dumbed-down version of their article. And their article essentially took a portfolio of securities in something like a 401k plan or a rollover IRA and said, wait, you know, there's so much volatility. It's going up and down. And it was obvious to them, and it became obvious to me, that if you draw on it when it's down, it's going to hurt the longevity of that portfolio. So what they did was substitute for some of that portfolio annuities. That is, they took something that was not volatile. They took out a portion of the portfolio that was volatile and replaced it with something not volatile. And that showed, they did a Monte Carlo simulation analysis. They published it and showed that that helped the duration, the sustainability of the portfolio. And I got very interested in that. So I published a dumbed down version of their article. Their article came from like 2001. I published mine in 2004 and kept thinking about it thereafter. And to fast forward to 2012, or just before then, the article got published early in 2012, the light bulb lit up over my head. Well, wait a minute, why take money away from the portfolio? Why not get some money from elsewhere to buttress the portfolio, something that is also not volatile, not correlated with the portfolio? And of course, being in California, one thinks of real estate. And that was when I got the first idea, which was a HELOC, a home equity line of credit, as a source of money that wouldn't be volatile like the portfolio.
Yeah, but jumping a teeny bit ahead, I mean, but HELOC was not the answer. And I imagine at that point, is that when you met Mary Jo? And
it
she was
shortly thereafter. Yeah, I began to think, well, HELOC is not the answer, because a HELOC, that's a loan that has to be repaid. It has to be repaid like any loan, of course, but while the retiree is living in the house that the HELOC is a lien against. So somehow the idea of what's another way to get money out of real estate. And I learned of reverse mortgages, and a friend of mine, or a guy who was working for the law firm that I had just left, actually, had retired from, was helping with, management issues and other things for them. He knew Mary Jo, who was in the reverse mortgage business already. And I met Mary Jo, and we became friends. We've remained friends ever since, which is now not quite the 20 years that Pete and I have known each other, but close to that. And once I realized that reverse mortgages could provide the offset to the volatility, Then my brother, who's a great computer program, wrote it up, programmed it on Excel spreadsheet. Monte Carlo simulated the volatility of the securities, and we published the article, wrote it in 2011. It was published in February of 2012.
And it truly was groundbreaking. And I think many people think that single-handedly that article kind of rehabilitated the notion of a reverse mortgage from its pretty, I don't know,
dodgy quality,
dodgy kind of reputation,
right.
Recognizing that it is a very different kind of asset class and one that can provide a very, very important role in retirement income strategy. But I wanted to ask you one other thing about that, Barry, which is that you mentioned volatility, but isn't volatility in this case really another way of talking about sequence of return risk?
Oh, sure.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference?
Of course.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, this sequence of returns is just another way of saying volatility. Mm. And volatility means that the portfolio goes up and it goes down. And the important thing to realize is that a retiree whose primary source of income is a portfolio of securities, such as a rollover IRA or 401k account, has to be drawing. They can't live on thin air. And most people, the vast majority of people who retire, have only two assets. That is to say, if they are lucky enough to have a portfolio of securities, that's one asset. And if they're lucky enough to have a home, which is, if not fully paid off, at least substantially paid off, that's the other source for most people. And now that we've got that situation, remember, let me just go back and say one thing. If they're not drawing on the portfolio, that is, if they're still working and having money come in from work, then it doesn't matter what the sequence of returns is, whether the big gains are early or the big gains are late, it doesn't matter. But when you're retired and drawing on that portfolio, then if the big losses or the even substantial, if not big, downturns occur early on in retirement, then that so depletes the portfolio that there's a risk of early exhaustion. And to run out of money when you're, you know, 10 years retired and you're looking to a 25 or 30 year retirement, that's a terrible situation. And to reduce the risk of a bad outcome in such a situation, you need an alternative source, what they call a buffer asset. And that's the thing that this use of a reverse mortgage, this use of it as a financial tool and not just a last resort, is the important thing to think of.
Well, yeah, yes. And I think the other aspect of that paper that really was kind of, like I said, groundbreaking is the fact that heretofore, there was no real recognition that in decumulation, during the decumulation phase, there are unique risks that are not present
exactly
during the accumulation. So
right,
sequence of return being one.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk, I hope, about some of the other unique risks in decumulation that are, you know, part of the current set of research that we're doing. But just moving on from the 2012 paper, which again, when you and I talked about it and you were telling me about it and I read it, I thought, wow, this is big and this is important. And I'd never thought about reverse mortgages before. And then you introduced me to Shelley Giordano,
right,
and then we had a conversation that led to some additional work.
So. Oh, yeah. In fact, that was, I think, a great event. It was terrific. Very interestingly, I published, I don't know, just because I worked faster than anybody else, the first article, and some other guys, some people from Texas Tech published one the same year, but much later. And then some other people, a guy named Jerry Wagner published an article, and Wade Fowle published an article, and every one of them, including me, and unbeknownst to one another, all used the same set of circumstances, that is to say, the same ratio of home value to portfolio value. It was a weird coincidence, but we all did. We just pick numbers. I had my reasons for picking them. I don't even know what the other people's reasons were. But it came out that we all had the same ratio, which oddly enough was a ratio that doesn't work very well with today's conditions. But in those conditions, it did. That ratio was that the home value was, I think, roughly half the portfolio value. Anyway, Pete took a look at this article. We had lunch. I wanted Pete to meet Shelley. Shelley happened to be in San Francisco and Pete worked there as I did. And Pete took a look at the article and said, that's interesting, but what about other ratios? And it never occurred to me to think whether it mattered. And it did. So we did the research. We ran the same computer program, but with different parameters. And going from ratio of 1 to 2, which was the original ratio, to 1 to 1, to 2 to 1. And we found that with current projections of investment returns, 2 to 1, that is where the house is worth twice as much as the portfolio, and numbers that we're using are $800,000 house and $400,000 portfolio, which turns out to be more realistic for most people than the converse. In any case, we published that in 2017. And again, it showed some remarkable, remarkable expansiveness to the range of situations in which this could produce some good results. And the good results we're talking about, at least the ones that we were talking about, now we've expanded it to more results, which was the 2022 paper, that is the most recent one. But the good results then were the fact that you got a lot of stability of cash flow throughout a 25 or 30 year retirement across a wide range of ratios for different initial distribution percentages. And that's important because, you know, the classic wisdom from 1994 is the 4% rule. And that says that if you draw 4% of the portfolio in the first year as your amount to draw and spend, this is looking only at the portfolio because nobody had thought of reverse mortgages or other buffer assets at the time, then you had a very good likelihood of cash flow being sustainable through a 30-year retirement. And we got numbers like 7%, 8%, 9%, where there was the home equity to be drawn upon using a coordinated strategy as opposed to a last resort when you had enough home equity to help.
Well, and I recall we had actually came up with a rule of 30, mm-hmm. which basically rather than look at a percentage of the portfolio, you look at the percentage of all of your assets. Exactly. And of course, that's been my gig for a while, which is to look at things holistically. Absolutely. And recognize that there's lots and lots of different circumstances. So basically my role was to just ask the question in that part. But then there was this person that I had not really known about, Mary Jo LeFay, who had been sort of a backroom collaborating with you, Barry, and she actually places these things.
Yeah.
At a certain point, we needed to know, really, is this practical? Can this really work? And so maybe you can talk a little bit about how you work with Mary Jo on some of these aspects.
Yeah, at this point, we're still learning more about reverse mortgages and how they're evolving. But Mary Jo has been a loan officer for nearly 20 years, placing them all over the place in a whole variety of circumstances. And the circumstance that we're still trying to get more widely accepted is the one that's been the subject of my article and then Pete's and my article. Mary Jo is out there. She's really a great people person and good and quantitatively oriented. So she's able to see people, talk to them about their real human situations and their needs. And many of them are simple, straightforward things like replacing a still existing forward mortgage, conventional, traditional mortgage, by a reverse mortgage so that the people's cash flow can won't be impacted by having to service a mortgage when they're no longer receiving work income. And also situations where in a divorce, one person can buy out the other person's interest in the house. What we're still dealing with getting at more acceptance on is this idea of using the reverse mortgage credit line as the buffer against the volatility of the securities portfolio. Conceptually, the idea is gradually gaining acceptance, but we haven't seen enough acceptance of it as the buffer asset to be used in coordination with a securities portfolio. We'd like to see this become more acceptable. I keep advancing the notion that we need influencers, a la Malcolm Gladwell's Tipping Point. And Pete says it's inevitable anyway, it's going to happen. But I think we have to help it happen and get people like financial planners or investment managers to recognize that the coordination is a very helpful thing. That is, when the portfolio has had a downswing in its volatility cycle, like we're experiencing right now, that's a good time not to draw on the portfolio, rather draw on a reverse mortgage credit line or any other buffer asset. One we occasionally think of is the cash value of life insurance. But if there are other buffer assets, that is things that can be drawn upon to avoid having to draw on a volatile securities portfolio when it's down, that's good also. Over time, I think acceptance will occur, but it's something that we have to get the message out on with more discussion, more explanation, and more of people becoming aware that this isn't just an interesting theoretical gambit. Right. It's really of great practical importance.
Right. And Mary Jo is fantastic at that practical aspect, mm-hmm. making it clear that you can actually do this. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to move just a little bit off of that to some of the other risks in decumulation, because yes, sequence of returns, I think you nailed it, and the reverse mortgage and the buffer asset is perfect for that. But as we started thinking about it in greater detail, we recognize that there's actually more than just a single unique risk in decumulation that makes the 4% rule not so good, or this coordinated approach and the use of a reverse mortgage more effective. But there are some other unique risks in decumulation, one of which that I like to call unpredictable contingent expense. You like to call it the spikes.
Spikes in spending. Yeah.
But it was thinking about those other risks that kind of led us to do some more work. And maybe you can share a little bit about we just came out with.
Well, we've got three other risks. One of them is brand new to our thinking. But let me talk about the older ones first, which is the risk of somebody needing a much larger chunk of money to spend. Because all the work until very recently that's been done has been based on a rather simple assumption, because the math was hard enough even with that simple assumption. And the simple assumption is spending is the same every year in real dollar terms. That is to say, the expense amount is the same year every year as it was the previous year, adjusted only for inflation. Well, that's good for math, but it's not good for life. And in reality, people do have occasional sudden needs for a big extra chunk of money. And that's the risk of that occurring has been evident to Pete and myself for a while. And we're trying to do, to fit into the math, some spikes to see what needs to be done to provide for that possibility. And obviously what needs to be done is a reduced regular amount, but how much, the quantification of that, that's what we're trying to determine. And at present, our programmer collaborator, Professor Steve Sachs, my brother, is working on that. And he's the programmer that's done all of the work up to now. And he's terrific. And this is a big project, which he's doing. Incidentally, I'll just mention in regard to that, that Wade Fow, who is a very prominent a researcher in this realm and part of the group that Shelley Giordano has put together, Wade is giving a talk, I think in the next week or so, that mentions non-constant spending. I don't know exactly what he's going to do. I've signed up for the talk to listen to it. So that's one of the risks. We've got the volatility. That's a risk. We've got the spikes. That's a risk. We got a third one. That's longevity. People live longer than our calculations show. What's the likelihood that they're going to have enough to continue to live on?
And just to interject, that's as an actuary, because that's one of my favorite risks as an actuary, is it's one of those risks that creeps up on you. You know, you can, when you're 55, you can think about longevity and say, well, I might live to 90 or I might live to that, but I don't know. And, you know, there was heart disease in my family, and so probably not. But then you get to 75 and suddenly you're still healthy. And that becomes, so it's one of those risks that really is kind of unique to decumulation, because it doesn't become apparent until you're well into your retirement ages, into your retirement process. And then there's the spikes that you mentioned. And then I guess the newest one that we have recently identified. But before we even get to that, I just want to talk about the 2022 paper that we came out with, because there we addressed another, I don't know, challenge or objection to the use of reverse mortgage, which is, but don't, what happens to the house? I mean, I wanted to leave my house to my kids. Now you're telling me I got a reverse mortgage. I'm not going to be able to do that. So we took a pretty hard look at both legacy and just what happens to your assets as you go through retirement.
Right. And of course, you know, it's in a sense quite senseless for somebody to say, well, you know, I want to leave my house to my kids. I may die at 85 and my kid will be 60 and I live in Des Moines and my kid lives in San Diego. The kid is not going to move back to Des Moines. The kid is 60. The kid is well established. Even the grandkids are established enough in Los Angeles or wherever. So the notion that you want to leave the house to a family member is not as meaningful as how much can I leave to the family members? And the quantity, the total legacy, is what we looked at. And we found that when the reverse mortgage is used in the coordinated strategy, yes, a lot of the house is encumbered, but a lot more of the portfolio remains. And it turns out that the legacy is, in fact, not undermined by the use of this coordinated strategy. Rather, it's at least kept even, and it's probably helped. Considering the amount of outflowing money to live on that the retiree has, there's still often plenty left. Now, obviously, the way we have to do this is we know that over time, once retirement occurs, all kinds of different possibilities will occur over the 20, 30 years that retirement takes place during. So when you have that, you have to look at this great big spread, this histogram of different possible results. Because after all, we're looking at what might happen in the future. And as Yogi Berra said, you know, when you're thinking about predictions, you got to be careful, especially ones about the future. So we're looking at the median outcome and the 10th percentile outcome. And we showed in both those cases, both those measures of legacy, using the coordinated strategy has the benefit of allowing people to live better, that is to have more cash flow and still not undermine the legacy. So that's a really good result. And people have to recognize that, so what if the house itself doesn't have much equity left in it at the time of the retiree's demise? As long as the aggregate of the home plus the portfolio is at least as good as it would have been under some other strategy, it's terrific.
And I think it goes beyond that, because I found more exciting aspects of the results we came up with, which, by the way, was published by the Conference of Consulting Actuaries. And it was not just about legacy, because the conference looked at it, at this paper, and they actually suggested that we rename it, because it also tracked the components of your net worth throughout retirement. And the paper ultimately got published. It was about generating lifetime income, which I think is really one of the keys of the decumulation phase. And as you look throughout retirement, we found that there was flexibility. And can you talk a little bit about how flexibility is important during the decumulation phase?
It's crucial. If you think about it, what we did was we compared two sets of situations. One set where the retiree uses the coordinated strategy, which simply says, as I've said before, whenever the portfolio was down, you draw from the reverse mortgage credit line. When it's up, you draw from it. Whereas the last resort strategy, by definition, says you go to the last resort. You go to the home equity only as a last resort when the portfolio is gone. Well, if you're drawing at the rate that we talk about, which are rates much higher than the 4% rule, then by definition, you're going to exhaust, if you use the last resort strategy, you're going to exhaust the portfolio first. And that turns out to occur relatively early in retirement, 10, 15 years out. And if you're using the last resort strategy, you're into the last resort. And that means that if you have an investment manager or a financial advisor, they can't do much for you if you use the last resort strategy. But if you use the coordinated strategy, then you've got some portfolio left and some home equity left. And that lets the investment manager or financial advisor take care of making adjustments to changing financial circumstances. If it turns out that it's a wise thing for a particular retiree to have more bonds and less stocks, because the situation is such that stocks are looking too risky, then that adjustment can be made if there's still a portfolio to make the adjustments in. But if the portfolio is gone, by definition, in the last resort strategy, it's too late. They can't do anything for you. And all they can do is let you draw the house down. Right. And you may survive okay, but there's been no flexibility, no ability to respond to economic situations.
Exactly. So I think we're almost out of time. And what I'd like to do just to finish this up is to get you to talk a little bit about what we're doing now, which is a more broader and maybe abstract look at these risks in decumulation. And maybe now is the time to talk about that fourth risk.
Yeah. And of course, as a tax lawyer, I should be particularly attuned to such things. But after all, the problem is that it's in terms of specific mathematical treatment, it's largely intractable unless we come up with some clever trick or some clever simplification, which maybe we will, maybe we won't. But certainly in broader terms, we can talk about it. And I'm not quite sure, because we just thought of this less than a week ago, as an issue that is put into the category of a risk like the other risks. That is to say, something might happen that can upset an otherwise reasonably stable apple cart. And how we focus that, I'm thinking in terms of simply saying margin of safety. That is, if tax rates, for whatever reason, go up, then one has to have some margin of safety, because the money that's drawn from a portfolio, typically a 401k account or a rollover IRA, is taxable as ordinary income. So it's got to be considered. Now, one possible way of dealing with that is to make a Roth conversion at some point. And right now, I'm actually working on a spreadsheet comparing Roth conversions by three different methods. But that's one way of building a cushion, but it's at some cost. It's at the cost of whatever assets you use to pay up front the tax, because tax might go up. Now, if it doesn't go up, it's like an insurance policy. You know, the house didn't burn down and you threw all that money away at the insurance company. Right. But you have to think about that risk, as any good actuary will. And one way of doing it, if not spending the money on the insurance policy, is to put money aside to self-insure. Right. And that's a way of considering it.
Right. So just, and I knew this would happen when I asked you to come on here, Barry, is that we would talk about these things and you would come up with an answer or a possible answer. And we would talk about it. And now we're probably going to spend the night. Well, and after this is over, we're going to spend some time talking about it.
I'm just
thrilled that you have been a collaborator with me over the years.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm just thrilled that you agreed to
it's been a
show
pleasure.
Your face on this radio show. So
it's nice to be in your studio here.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Okay.
And I guess we'll kick it back to our host.
Our producer.
I was really fascinated and want more and more details. In fact, a ton of this information, the research papers that you've written together, are on peternewirth.com. Click on the research box and you will find all of that and more. Pete is incredibly prolific and Barry is just an amazing resource and educator and a brilliant mind in this field. So you mentioned Mary Jo LaFay. She will be the next guest on your show, Pete. And she is with Mutual of Omaha, and she is definitely an awesome collaborator. So we're excited to have Mary Jo LaFay come on the next show, episode 2 of Money Mountaineering with Peter Neuwirth. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, producer of the Incandescent Radio Network, and we look forward to many more episodes of Pete's show. So thank you both for your time tonight. We thank our audience, and we will talk to you again next month.